Clifford Brown on trumpet and Harold Land on tenor sax, opening up Brown's composition Sandu, which is considered a jazz classic. It's from Study in Brown, a 1955 collaborative album with drummer Max Roach, and also featuring Richie Powell on piano and George Morrow on double bass. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and an interesting program. I think you will find it today. We talked about it yesterday. I told you to tune in. It's going to be a riveting program because we are asking questions worth asking about James Comey. Washington is still reeling from the seemingly out-of-nowhere firing Tuesday of FBI Director James Comey by President Donald Trump. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his deputy Rod Rosenstein delivered a 1-2 punch that knocked Comey out of his prized position. Comey had done a bad job with the Hillary Clinton email investigation, they told Trump. By implication, other major investigations currently underway could suffer the same fate in Comey's hands and rob Trump of political victories that he badly needs. Did Comey mishandle the Hillary Clinton email investigation, as Trump and his advisors believe? Did he have reason to, quote, go soft, unquote, on her and husband Bill? Despite claims of doing things by the book, was Comey a compromised lawman? These questions emerge in a unique way here on Lead Stories, because our guest today has been studying a specific part of this question and has reason to see it differently. This whole question about the firing of Comey, what does it mean, and is Comey an innocent in all of this? Our guest, of course, is Charles Ortel. He has spent the last almost two and a half years studying the Clinton Foundation. And we've been discussing every single discovery that he has made in going through the figures, the records of the Clinton Foundation. And this firing is the most recent development in the long story of Bill and Hillary Clinton and their foundation, which Charles Ortel says is the largest unprosecuted fraud, charity fraud, in U.S. history. So today we're going to take a look at the connection, the strange connection between James Comey and the Clintons, and the Clinton Foundation. You know, when the firing was announced, and no question it was crude, but then again, it was perfectly in line with the crude president that we have, to fire him that way, to fire Comey that way. But there, as we discussed, there are many underlying factors that we are not seeing. And they involve, of course, the president. They involve his top personnel in different capacities in his administration. But Comey has, of course, now taken center stage. Comey, as you know, was undertaking a couple of very, very important investigations, one of them including Hillary Clinton and her email scandal. So that was one. We had also Comey undertaking another investigation involving President Trump. and whether he provided unusual cooperation and access by the Russian government to the democratic process, the electoral process, and other unnamed issues in the United States. That is still supposedly ongoing. But what we want to deal with in this particular program is the connection between Comey and the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation. Our guest is a very familiar voice here, and he has no life, as he tells me all the time. He has had no life for the past 2.5 years, looking into the Clinton Foundation as an expert in charity operations in the United States and abroad. He has already shared with us some extraordinary findings as he has combed through the records of the foundation, and everything pointed to a reason to look into this foundation, which by his estimation has somehow involved itself in at least $1 trillion of transactions. Supposedly, these are charity transactions that the Clintons have yet to explain. And we have heard from others, especially from Dadi Sheri, a reporter who joined us to tell us some of the details of what went on in Haiti, particularly, where it was just mind-boggling how the Clintons conducted themselves there, and with complete immunity, it seemed. Charles Ortel blew the whistle on Wall Street fraud in 2007-2008, when he proved that many companies, many giants, including GE and General Motors and AIG, had overvalued their stocks by hundreds of billions of dollars. He was the guy who did that. And he has been blowing the whistle on the Clinton Foundation for quite some time now, and showing the global enterprise that the foundation actually has been, and in many ways still continues to be, and apparently with nobody, no agency taking full charge of a review of its operations. Charles, great to be with you today.
Well, thanks so much, Eutrice, for having me back on.
Thanks. Well, it seems as if, where you and I and the folks on Lead Stories are concerned, all roads eventually lead to the Clinton Foundation. And this is no exception. The firing of the former FBI director is no exception.
Absolutely. And I think it's long overdue.
Could you tell us, give us an overview of the link here between Comey and the foundation? And what are you going to tell us in this hour? You're going to guide us through a series of links that separately don't look all that important, but especially in light of this most recent development, take on a special significance.
Well, I think the overarching headline is that you don't hire a swamp creature if you want to drain the swamp. It doesn't make any sense to do that. And when you go into the timeline on James Comey, and I have no doubt that for portions of his long career, he has been well-meaning, well-intentioned. But sadly, when you look carefully at the record, and there is a record, and you go back over ground that is cold now, but will soon heat up very much, you see a pattern and a set of conflicts that should have disqualified James Comey from even from running the FBI in the first place. By the time he got back to it, appointed by Obama, former President Obama, I believe, or he started, according to the summary that I just read, on September 4th, 2013. Now, why is that date important? This is after the 2012 election, but it's while the fury over what may have happened in Benghazi and the questions there were raging. It's also about a month after the New York Times, two reporters whose names I now forget, wrote, you know, this is going to be coming from me, an odd sentence, but wrote some very good analysis in the New York Times about concerns that Clinton loyalists had over the state of play in the foundation in August 2013. So scant weeks before James Comey sits in as head of the FBI, who takes over the FBI. Now, that's our premier investigative body, right? That's the most powerful. Some would argue it's the strongest investigative force on the planet. All right? So Obama puts Comey in there. What was not revealed at that time? When you go back over his record, and again, this is all I do is in the public domain. I don't reach out for sources. I'm only interested in finding out what somebody can see in the public domain. And when you go into Comey's record, and you remember a history that perhaps some of your listeners have forgotten or didn't want to think about, when Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton exited the White House around January 20th, 2001, scant moments later, the world found out that Bill Clinton had pardoned Mark Rich. Literally all hell broke loose.
Could you identify Mark Rich so that people know the significance of that name?
So Mark Rich was somebody who's now passed away, but who made probably billions of dollars over time. Some would argue breaking the law, you know, trading illegally, and he was a fugitive. He had, some would say, returned home to his home in Switzerland. Others would say fled the country, U.S., because he had, it is alleged, been breaking the then sanctions against doing business with Iran, and he'd been trading with Iran and making lots of money in the black market, selling, I believe, Iranian oil onto the world market in violation of U.S. sanctions. So unlike other people who get pardoned, Mark Rich had never stood trial. He had never been sentenced. He'd never spent time in prison. But he gets this very controversial pardon in the dead of night in a process that people still are debating. How did it actually happen? You know, people like, I believe, the former Attorney General Eric Holder claimed that he wasn't really fully in the loop on it, even though at that time he was working for in Justice Department, I believe, in a position where he should have known more than he claimed after the fact to have known. So it was a very controversial matter, and it immediately prompted the kind of investigation that should have been ongoing with the Clinton Foundation, but I believe has not yet been ongoing. And we know this because last summer, without much explanation, if you Google something called the FBI Vault and you Google Clinton Foundation, you'll get to, I forget how many pages it is now, from memory it could be 700 or so pages, of heavily redacted files concerning an investigation that was prosecution, the criminal investigation and seating of a grand jury. That piece of it initially was handled by somebody called James Comey. And the FBI was involved because you see the meeting notes. And when you read it carefully, and you've got to go through page after page after page of redacted material, so it's not like reading a book. You have to, like, really be patient. Towards the end of each of the two packs, it's two different sections, you'll see that basically what it seems one grand jury that then ran out of time and a second grand jury was investigating in the period 2001 to 2005 was whether the Clinton Foundation was used as a means of laundering payments and public corruption. Now, why did this leap off the page to me? This is precisely the period even today, sitting here on the 11th of May, 2017, almost coming up now 20 years into the existence of the Clinton Foundation, in the crucial period where the Clinton Foundation first got its start and was supposed to be a presidential archive, that is to say, a repository for the presidential records created or received while Bill Clinton was president from January 93 to January 2001. Even now, in this period from October 23, 1997, when the thing was formed, through December 31st, 2004, the final year in which they had completed the construction, there is still not a legally compliant audit of the Clinton Foundation in this crucial period. So no outside group, as is required in numerous states where the Clinton Foundation did solicit in this time period, there's never been an honest accounting, verifiable accounting of how much money was raised and which donors, you know, provided what sums, how many of these donors may have been agents of influence for people seeking favors from the U.S. government and governments themselves. There's never been an honest accounting of this. And all this while, in the beginning, James Coney was a U.S. attorney who was tasked with trying to win an indictment, and evidently none was handed out, which we know we haven't seen anything in the public that one was handed out, but trying to win an indictment. And he couldn't do that, and then his successor couldn't do it. And actually, after Comey was there in 2002 and 2003, in I believe 4 and 5, he was the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, the very same person, the same position as the man who currently has recommended, or just recommended, that Comey be fired as FBI director. He was a very powerful man back then. He had all the resources of seated grand juries, the FBI at his beck and call, the resources of the Department of Justice, and somehow he couldn't even get a grand jury indictment, let alone proceed to a trial with a slam dunk charity fraud case. It beggars belief. And, you know, you can see this. I'm being so definitive because there just simply is not an audit in this time frame. And it is not only impossible, it's reckless beyond belief for the trustees of the Clinton Foundation to allow the type of behavior that happened back then to have happened then, and subsequently for all succeeding groups of trustees to continue to hold out to the public that this is a validly organized and operated charity when it certainly is not. In addition,
let me ask you I want to break in here while it's fresh in my mind. What then would you say was the political arrangement, if you think there was one, a political arrangement between the Clintons and Comey?
I think what was going on back then is the following. If we go back into history, we remember the election of 2000, and we remember how bitter the aftermath of the immediate election result was, how it was, you know, people still to this day are fuming over the notion that, in theory, George W. Bush was selected, not elected by, the Supreme Court in the end. And so it was a very bitter and, I don't like to pronounce it this way, but I'll say divisive moment in American history. And, you know, one might argue that George W. Bush certainly didn't begin his first term with a clear mandate. Let's just put it politely. So in the beginning, this is really one of the first controversies he had to deal with, this controversial last-minute pardon by Bill Clinton, just as Bill Clinton was surrendering his law license for having lied under oath and obstructed justice, possibly, in connection with his various personal matters that occurred during his term. So it was a very, very controversial period, and the Democrats were up in arms. Many Republicans were up in arms, frankly. And the problem here is that as the investigation started, remember the Markrich thing started in, I believe, by March 2001, the world was falling apart. We had the various Enron scandals proceed, and then there are lots of other corporate scandals and lots of allegations and suspicions that maybe campaign contributors to the Bush campaign. They have been involved in these scandals, and they know it's a toxic area. And then as this thing proceeded, and one wonders, I mean, somebody knows what actually happened with this investigation. Somebody understands what actually happened. But at a certain moment, Bill Clinton decided that, you know, just setting up a little library in Little Rock was not much of a job for him, and he wanted to fly around the world, and let's be charitable and say that he really wanted to address global problems. So he changed the mission of the Clinton Foundation. And then they very cleverly, in my view, got George H.W. Bush involved. And sadly, of course, Bill Clinton had developed heart problems. So I think what happened was that an accommodation was made, that, you know, people just said, well, you know, this is too complicated. Maybe they screwed up, but, you know, they're just trying to do good works here. Let's give Bill a chance. And you know, in essence, the Uniparty, the Bush wing of the Republican Party, in my view, and the Clinton and later Obama wing of the Democratic Party decided that, you know, wasn't such a bad idea to allow these post-presidential foundations to give former presidents a global calling card to go around the world, fatten their personal coffers by making speeches and writing books, and, you know, claim they were doing something useful. And so the model for these presidential foundations changed. And, excuse me, sorry about that noise. You know, I think that basically a decision was likely made at the highest levels to just, you know, give the Clintons a pass on the early problems with the Clinton Foundation and let sleeping dogs lie. And then so then thereafter, we know the history as well. What happens, of course, is that George W. Bush's second term ends, I would argue, in disaster between, you know, the mayhem in the Middle East and the meltdown in markets. And, you know, Hillary and Bill and others can taste the notion that she will become the first female president starting in 2009 and be able to wallpaper over all these problems and bury it for good. And the swamp monster, the creature created in the swamp, this Clinton Presidential Foundation, has ever since, you know, been feeding upon itself and feeding upon this country and feeding upon the entire world, literally.
So do you think that from that time until now, the arrangement between James Comey and the Clintons is that the Clintons should enjoy, especially based on their foundation, they should enjoy a certain amount of consideration and special dispensation from law enforcement, from the Justice Department, from the IRS, and Comey could have been a very critical part of setting that in motion.
Well, again, I'm speculating on Comey, but I think this is, to put it in perhaps its most charitable light, I am guessing that the people around the Clintons, around the Bushes, around the Obamas, you know, were flabbergasted at the extent of this mess and realized at a certain moment that the American public just wouldn't understand that a presidential foundation and so many smart people around that foundation, both of the, you know, the Bush foundations that I would argue have been hoodwinked, and the Clinton Foundation that was, in my view, it was a fraud from the very beginning. It was never intended to truly be a presidential foundation. It was always meant to be a loosely controlled, Arkansas in theory, regulated, so that means unregulated, excuse for the Clinton machine and people now like Terry McAuliffe and others to, you know, use the arguments and the aura, the positive aura in the minds of some of Bill Clinton, as an excuse to just run riot around the world. So as a guess, what happened at each day, it's like when you encounter something like this, and I can say that one time, I can't say in what area precisely, but I can say that one time I was confronted with a fraud. And what the clever fraudster does is to involve you in the fraud and then tell you, you know, well, you might want to expose this, but the problem with that, my friend, is that you're going to indict yourself. And that's really what I think has happened here. This has been a fraud from the beginning. With each day that it passes, it becomes ever more a fraud. And those who touch it, particularly now some of these billionaire donors and foreign governments, you know, to admit, you know, Bill Gates, for example, to admit that his foundation from starting in 2001 with then a jump until 2005, and then from 2005 forward has been centrally involved in a fraud that escaped the attention of the deep staff at the Gates Foundation, and Bill himself is, you know, thought to be reasonably smart, is a tough one to admit. And what about all the other big people who've given money to these foundations? And what about all the big governments around the world? So you draw them into the thing, and then, you know, the message comes down and says, listen, we got to bottle up. So the approach we're going to take is, you know, Jim, why don't you fight terror? Why don't you do the things that are very important? But when it comes to looking into this Clinton Foundation, you know, you just got to make sure that they clean up their act one way or another. And we'll do our best to make it tough for people to get on the trail of seeing what really happened. I might add that Barack Obama in this had a major conflict. There has a major conflict. And that is, we talked about it before, that in 2010, I believe it was in March of 2010, Barack and Michelle Obama kindly, frankly, and errantly donated more than $200,000 via the Clinton Foundation to the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. And in so doing, have still a tax problem because neither the main foundation or the Bush Haiti thing was properly organized or operated at any time. And an IRS that was actually an honest IRS, an honest broker that was administering our complex tax code fairly, would tag both Michelle and Barack Obama, as well as the Clinton Foundation, as well as all the entities around it. And that also, another, and it does get a little complicated here, but another conflict is in the area of this educational firm, Laureate, that we talk about, because that for-profit entity is advised by the law firm DLA Piper, which is a respected firm and a big firm, so it has many clients. And it also happens to be the firm that was working, I believe, in association with the Clinton Foundation in 2015 to examine whether or not the Clinton Foundation had to refile its taxes. And I believe that there's a potential conflict involving James Comey's brother via this firm. But there certainly are myriad conflicts of interest involving the people who finance Laureate, who also donate to the Clinton Foundation, themselves, who have failed to properly account for the substantial incomes that Bill earned as honorary chancellor of Laureate in the various Clinton Foundation filings, both personal, the Clinton Family Foundation, as well as all the different Clinton entities. None of these related party conflicted transactions has been properly disclosed anywhere. So it's just, as they would say in England, one right mess.
Comey, prior to becoming the director of the FBI, had some troubling connections with corporations. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So I believe that, and I don't know the precise chronology, but I believe that Comey was a director, a general counsel of a very large defense contractor, Lockheed Martin. And some argue that once you get close to being that size, you're by definition a charter member of the swamp, because most of these defense contractors are so heavily dependent upon long-term contracts, and Lockheed Martin is no exception. So many people, rightly, are deeply suspicious of anybody who would be a senior figure in a defense contractor. And, of course, James Comey would be front and center as general counsel, I believe he was, considering such issues as, you know, were any Lockheed Martin sales to foreign governments? arranged potentially improperly? What about the same question for, you know, transactions with our government? You know, there's various thorny issues there. And, of course, where big money is involved in long time frames, all sorts of, you know, swamp creatures and vultures get into the act. So that's one area. He also, I believe, the firm that I think started out in Hong Kong, Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC, you know, any of these big banks, particularly in the period after 2000 or 2006 forward, any large bank is going to have problems. And HSBC, I mean, it's just so complicated. There's so many rules and regulations, and there's so much temptation, and there are, frankly, so many crooks who migrate to where the money is. HSBC has had a series of problems, one of which involved, I believe, its banking operations in Geneva. Now, Geneva is a place where over really many centuries, people go to hide money. And our rules have been tightened up a lot, as they should be. And HSBC has fallen afoul of these rules, as has many other banks. And James Comey was, I forget exactly when, but he was asked to serve, after HSBC was tagged for one offense or another, he was asked to serve as a director. And again, as somebody familiar as operating as a director of a bank like that, with his background, should really understand that it is extremely dangerous for a foundation like the Clinton Foundation to attempt to hide that its single largest donor is an entity called Unitaid, based in Geneva, Switzerland, that has advanced towards the Clinton Foundation in excess of $500 million. And a lot of that money doesn't seem to show up in the ways that it should show up properly in Clinton Foundation financial states. There are massive discrepancies starting in 2006-07. And going right the way through this period where James Comey becomes head of the FBI and then continues serving in the FBI. So you look at something like this, and clearly, you know, when you're running the FBI, it's such a big organization, if you've done anything in your life previously, you're probably going to have some potential conflicts to think about. But in this instance, there's just too many of them, and in hindsight, when you look at this, when you think about the condition the Clinton Foundation was in, with the New York Times writing about concerns August 2013, with, you know, Hillary now out, cooling her heels, trying to think about what to do next, does it look as if the placement of James Comey as head of the FBI was to make sure that we had our toughest cop on the beat? Or was James Comey selected to just put a stopper in things and, you know, fight, you know, pretend that he was sort of fighting the good fight, but to make sure that this mess at the Clinton Foundation didn't blow up and impede Hillary's ability to become the next president of the United States? And in the minds of the various people who were looking at this, you know, then be in power for at least 4 years, maybe eight. And it sure looked to many, frankly, to most, on the political spectrum, through the even election night, it came as a major shock. Election night that Hillary actually lost. So, now I think when we go back over this ground, as we must go back now over this ground, and we think about what was really going on here, and then we start asking, you know, what's going on at the Obama Foundation as well? What are they trying to do? And did Barack Obama and did Valerie Jarrett and the people around those, you know, experienced people, did they really understand what the Clinton Foundation was doing prior to entering the White House on January 20th or whatever it was, 2009? Did they really know the true state of the Clinton Foundation? And when they did finally find out, because somebody found out, this thing has been so mucked over, so reorganized, there have been so many bad decisions taken by so many people, many of whom are smart and rich and experienced. You know, was the reaction in the Obama camp, well, okay, you know, we can't beat him, we may as well join him. Let's set up to turn our own foundation into the Clinton Foundation on steroids.
Well, the HSBC bank in which Comey finally becomes involved with as a member of its board of directors is also linked to a number of unsavory things in the United States, apart from, you know, the other things outside of the United States, LIBOR and other things like that. But in when we talked about Detroit, HSBC was one of the banks that was accused by community people of basically accelerating the foreclosures on their properties. It was one of the banks singled out in that regard. But HSBC also is connected to the Clinton Foundation. Could you discuss that?
Yeah, I believe that I think it is the case that a number of donors to the Clinton Foundation, I believe I've got this right, may have sent donations in, a number of American donors and also foreign donors, they have sent donations in via HSBC's Geneva branch without necessarily fully notifying the IRS, in the case of the U.S., persons that they held these accounts in Switzerland. And I think that also is a case with some other banks as well. I believe this came out through the Panama Papers. This is an open area. One might wonder, you know, why are you sending money anyway from an offshore account to a charity? What's the point of that? You know, it would seem to be a rather, it's illegal, first of all, if you're American without disclosing the account, but, you know, that's pretty aggressive, right? You've got offshore money that may or may not have paid its American taxes properly. Now you're remitting it to a U.S. charity and writing that amount off your U.S. tax return. So when you start to bring all these things up, I mean, James Comey is not a stupid individual. He's not somebody who has had, you know, limited experience in government. He's not somebody who doesn't understand how investigations work and prosecutions work. I mean, he's a pretty seasoned guy. And, you know, I really do think Americans and people around the world need to have confidence that our highest government officials play by the rules, the same rules they make us play by. And, you know, as we didn't talk about this, we've talked about it before, but Corinne Brown is in the middle of, you know, really the torture chamber, perhaps validly so, over an $800,000 alleged slush fund that she and her colleague may have run. And she's in the middle of a trial literally for her life. I mean, if she's convicted, she goes to prison for 357 years, which is tough to do.
Corinne Brown, I should mention, is a congresswoman from Florida, and she was indicted on charges of charity fraud, stealing money from a charity that was supposed to give scholarships to young people, poor young people. It turned out, according to the trial, I've been following it, of $800,000 raised, only one scholarship was given, and the rest disappeared in some interesting ways, allegedly in the pockets of Corinne Brown herself and her chief aide, who just spent the money on all kinds of things, including buying tickets to football games and going on vacations and that kind of thing. So she's currently on trial for that, and the penalties are severe. She faces several decades in prison. So we're looking at that. It's an interesting contrast to the way that the Clinton Foundation is being treated. I want to get back to this question. When Comey announced that he could find no reason, there's no evidence, there's nothing to indict Hillary Clinton, for with regard to the emails that and the private email server that she had in the basement of her home. What was your reaction? Did you link up these things, the past links between Comey and the Clintons, with this most recent forgiveness, if you will? He said not only did he not see any evidence, they did not have any evidence against Hillary Clinton on that count of the email issue, but that no prosecutor, I mean, he went so far as to say no prosecutor would proceed with an indictment in that case. What did you make of that?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I know enough about this area to say that my immediate reaction, I was stunned. It was utter rubbish. Anybody who is familiar with the rules would know immediately that what he did was so wrong on so many different levels. In the first instance, it is not the job of the FBI director to lead prosecutions. It is the job of the FBI investigator or the team looking at this to decide whether or not it makes sense to encourage the department to refer to the Department of Justice the assignment of mounting a process, of seeking an indictment, mounting a prosecution. That's the job. And so, from the starting point, I mean, the news conference that they launched was odd for many reasons. But when he went down the track of when he started making the case that no reasonable prosecutor would conclude there was the required intent necessary to convict somebody of a crime, he was lying. The statute in question, so that lawyers tell me, and I've looked at it myself, specifically is intended, the espionage statutes are intended to put the fear of God into anybody handling this very sensitive material, that you will go away for a long time if you fail to take appropriate care of it. Now, you know, the issue here, just to go into the weeds a little bit, is that there's certain information that is so sensitive that you can't take it out of what is called a secure, compartmentalized, I forget what the I stands for, facility, SCIF. And these are specially hardened rooms that, in theory, outsiders can't penetrate. And when you go into these rooms, you're not allowed to go in there with a laptop or a camera or a pen or anything. You know, you read the material, there are guards posted, and I've been into it. These type of rooms with people who have to explain how this does work. And you're not allowed to, as I say, to transfer this material to an unsecure location like your bedroom or, you know, the entrance hall of your house in Chappaqua. You're not allowed to do that or your house in Washington, D.C. And for each time that you take one scrap of this sensitive information, whether you intended to or not, whether it slipped into your pants by accident, you know, or into your pantsuit by accident, it doesn't matter. You hold these high-level security clearances. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she was among the most senior federal government officials out there, whatever it is, fourth or fifth in line to be president of the United States. I mean, it's just preposterous to say that she had to intend to divert this material, or Uma Abedin had to intend to. The statute does not say that. So when he hung his argument on the notion that there was no possible prosecution because there was no intent, it was a bold-faced lie, and a lot of people called him on it, including Judge Napolitano, who through this whole process has been one of the most perceptive, fair-minded people. Going through, he immediately called him out, as did many other people. And so then the second piece of it was, for me anyway, when he said, "Well, there will be no prosecution, but let me tell you all the ways in which, you know, she was excessively reckless and sloppy and this and that." It's just not the way it works, or is supposed to work in this country. Our investigative premier force, the FBI, has enormous tools at its fingertips. And we are in this country, unless things have changed, innocent until proven guilty. So there's a bar the government has to do its work, honestly, in compliance with the Constitution and other regulations. And then if they decide decision is made, the fullness of inquiry to seek an indictment, you got to play by the rules. You don't say, well, we studied this, and we found this and this and this and this and this, which are embarrassing and reckless and, you know, horrible, but nonetheless, we're not going to do anything. You're not supposed to do that. And he knows that. And the people around him know that. So he satisfied nobody, I would argue, July 5th. That was the beginning of his problem. And, you know, I would say many, clearly people who did not want Hillary to win were upset with him. But equally, I would argue that people who were Hillary partisans were also upset with him. And then he compounded the error in whenever it was, October 28th, by, as he did, announcing that he had no option but to inform people, because he testified before Congress, that he was resuming the investigation over the Anthony Weiner and Uma Abedi cache of emails that were supposedly discovered up here in New York. That was a mistake. So, I mean, this is, people are going to go over this for some time. But the problem when you do this is that you erode the confidence and the integrity of the system of justice. And that's the last thing that you want to do, because in this crazy world we're in, where there's so much tumult all over the place and there's so many rising problems, once again, in financial markets, the one advantage the U.S. has, or I should say held, over many other nations, is that our system of laws has functioned. We're now... with defects, of course, but for many, many decades. And investors around the world, people who want to park money here, invest money here, had some comfort, more than in other places, that if funds were sent here to buy shares or bonds or assets in this country, they could have some confidence that this is a safe place. And that's an advantage for every single person here who needs money.
But, you know, the storyline still is a fascinating one, in that James Comey didn't become a problem, quote unquote, just now. You've talked about his origins, if you will, at this high level of operation, all the way back to the Clinton era, then to the Obama era, now to the Trump era. And all along, you're pointing to some serious conflicts of interest that should have been raised really early in the game. And the compounding of the issue is that now with Trump, I mean, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but I'm raising this as an issue. Here you have the head of the FBI, who essentially had been co-opted by Hillary Clinton, now working for her opponent, and he is currently investigating Trump. Now, how is this supposed to play out, other than we could see from many of the reports that we've had along the way that Comey basically has taken the attitude, or had taken the attitude from early on with Trump, that he's running his own show. He doesn't have to respect the president that he's working for, because his loyalties are to Hillary Clinton from another era that continue up until now. So how is this to be fixed, you think?
Well, I think it's past time to rip off, you know, the bandages that are obscuring the eyes of most Americans, and discard this theory that there really is deep conflict between Democrats and Republicans. In fact, what has emerged in Washington in the swamp and in the state capital swamps is a marrying of interests among the established party members, big unions, whether they're public sector or private sector, the media complex, the banks, defense establishment, the pharmaceuticals. It's all one big common set of interests. And, you know, and the entertainment complex. And the mass of humanity in this country, we're much better off than in most other nations. But it's not simply that incomes aren't distributed evenly. They're never going to be. It's that the economic conditions under this swamp, under this new globalist system, where national laws don't get respected, where there's no regulation of multinationals and big complex enterprises, in this environment with these machines and technology, everybody's income, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, progressive, what, everybody's income in this country has been under threat for a long time, and where none of us is truly better off. And the swamp, those who run the swamp, are very happy to pit a Democrat against a Republican or a, you know, and just let the fight continue as they buy time and hope that a solution may be engineered. So instead, you know, I think we saw some of it last year, in part thanks to you, Teresa, the people, I mean, if 5 years ago, I'm not so sure you would have invited me on the program or I would have known about you. But I think what's going on is that people who do care, and I believe progressives and conservatives, I don't know about liberals so much, but progressives and conservatives really do care that this country be fixed and put back on a right path, correct path, that lifts us all up, gives us a chance to be safe, free, and prosper. And so we have to have these type of discussions, get into it, and now we have to understand. We really need to understand exactly what happened at the Clinton Foundation. It is a very good case study, you know, to understand why did the IRS under George W. Bush, under Barack Obama, why has the IRS chosen to give the Clinton Foundation a complete pass? Why have all the state taxing authorities, why has Mr. Schneiderman here in New York, who is so quick to jump down the throat properly at Donald Trump, why has he given the Clinton Foundation a complete pass here in New York, operating from secret, undisclosed offices, we find out now, without filing the paperwork properly, lying on paperwork, omitting damaging disclosures. Why has he given it a pass? You know, same questions in California. Why is this man, Xavier Becerra, the Attorney General of California, saying on the one hand that he wants to go after and regulate charities, and on the other hand, giving this Clinton fraud a complete pass? And there are many other states that have high tax rates, including the home state for the Clinton Foundation in Arkansas. Why is there no legally compliant paperwork on any part of the Clinton Foundation in the home state of Arkansas, which is today controlled by Republicans? You know, why is that the case? And, you know, why are all these foreign governments? You look at the government of France, and I won't pick on the new the winner of the election. I could take a joke at him, but I won't do it. You know, there's a country that is on its heels, that has very high taxes, whose citizens have given it. The largest donors to the Clinton Foundation are in France. Why don't they complain that over $300 million has been sent via the French government to the Clintons, but never, it's disappeared, never been accounted for? Why are they complacent? Why are the people in the UK complacent, in Australia, in Sweden, in Norway? And we've talked before about other issues, the HIV issues. I mean, why are we giving these people a pass and allowing them to pretend and preen as if they've actually done anything other than divert money from people who truly deserve to have money? The people in Haiti, you talked about Dottie. Now we learned the people in Bangladesh today. There's a great story in Circa, this new entity online, about how Hillary Clinton herself may have pressured the prime minister of Bangladesh to not go after this man, Mr. Yunus, who created what I would believe is another fraud called Grameen micro-lending operation. I mean, when you look at this, the way most of us are judged in our daily lives, it's just, how do you defend this?
This is a question. So you continue your study of the foundation, and you are finding out more and more that this is a major criminal enterprise. And we're finding out also that it enjoys a great deal of protection and has enjoyed a great deal of protection from the U.S. government. Most recently, the FBI, under the direction of James Comey. Hopefully, we'll find out some more as it goes, but that's where we are at the moment. And people need to understand, don't accept what you see as being what is real. You have to wait a bit and start asking questions, and then you put two and two together. That's how it works. The media, I mean, it's very tough to do given the pressure of the media to propagandize everything and to present a reality that really isn't. It gives you an alternative view to take your mind in a whole different place from where it ought to be. I'm glad, though, that we have the benefit of people like Charles Ortel to dig and dig until we find the answers to the questions that we need answered. So, Charles, thanks again for being with us today. An extraordinary presentation today, and you shared a lot of information that puts this whole current debacle into proper perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chief.
Okay. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at Lead Stories, LEID Stories at gmail.com. And as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. As you know, tomorrow it's Free Your Mind Friday. See you then. Bye-bye.